Working Cows Podcast, Episode 75.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Hi, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows podcast, here with special guest Alan Savory for episode 75. He's been on the list since the very start of the podcast as a person I'd like to get on, and just so excited about the opportunity to sit down with him. Alan is a man who has had an incredible influence. I've heard it said one time sitting at a group gathering of ranchers that there hasn't been a new idea in the industry since Alan Savory in 1984, and as you'll hear today, that history goes back even before that. So, Alan, it is a privilege to have you on. Thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows podcast.
Thank you, Clay.
As I've done some research in preparation for this episode, I have heard you say on a couple of occasions that grazing systems don't work, or that they tend to fail. Why is that? Why is it that grazing systems are not something that we should be shooting to have? I guess that kind of challenges a paradigm for me a little bit.
Now, that's a good point to start on. All grazing systems fail by definition. André Voisin, who studied rotational grazing systems in Europe, which have been there for hundreds of years, found that they're losing biodiversity, etc. So he was the first person to really discover, and I always credit him, that we had to replace grazing systems with some form of planning process. He came up with his rational grazing, which is a planning process. It's not a grazing system. It's not rotational grazing. Highly successful in Europe. So I tried that right away in Africa, and I fell on my face. We had more complexity in Africa and the tropics and so on. And I realized Voisin wasn't wrong, that he was right, but we needed something more sophisticated, albeit simple. And so I developed holistic plan grazing process. And that's really based on 300 years of military planning experience for planning in immediate battlefield conditions, planning very complicated situations that can change. And I just adapted that and had to put it on a chart to express longer dimensions than short battles. And it worked immediately, and we've never, ever had a single failure, never yet in over 50 years. People just keep confusing it with grazing systems. Okay, so why they fail is very easy for anybody to understand with common sense. If you, Clay, run any business, any farm, any business, any business, you would never run it with a business system. You would run it with sophisticated planning using the latest knowledge available to you on any day, and that's how you would run your business. Now, within your business, you would use management systems for everything that is predictable. So you would have an accounting system for your accounting because it's predictable. You would have an inventory control system for your inventory. In any shop, you look at it, you see it. So, okay? So management systems have their place where everything's predictable. Now, the moment you're running the livestock on the land and bringing into account the cultural, social, economic, the wildlife, the crops, the other uses on the land, it's absolute BS to think that you can ever do this with mob grazing, rotational grazing, any grazing system. And so it really frustrates me when it's so simple and yet people just keep reverting back to various grazing systems.
And I've heard you mention that that is one thing that your critics have used to discount what you're talking about, is that they've set up this straw man of a grazing system and they've never actually tested it with a plan. They've tried to say these systems don't work because they are using these systems rather than following a plan.
Absolutely. You can take any one of them, Briscoe, Holacek, any of them, and you'll find they set up, as you say, a straw man grazing, rotational, mob, something, some sort of grazing, and they prove that it doesn't work or establish that it doesn't do what I claim. But that's if they looked at my work, I said that 50 years ago, that those don't work. And when we were training, or I was training 2,000 professional people for USDA in the early 80s, I got them to first understand the holistic plan grazing process. Once they understood it, I said, let's treat it as a hypothesis. What is the scientific method? And it is you develop a hypothesis and then you prove or disprove it, and so you move on. And I said, all right, this is a planning process. It's not a hypothesis. But I want you to treat it as a hypothesis. So you all understand it now. And I said, I want you to work in teams, and I want you to come up with some theoretical way of causing it to fail. Because if you can cause this process to fail in theory, then we're going to have trouble down the line in practice. But I can tell you that 2,000 people doing that gave up in despair every time and said, damn it, you cannot make this fail even in theory. The only way we can bring about failure is not to do it. And that's exactly what all the critics do. They don't do it. So when you've had a sample that big of people and they cannot even make it fail in theory, I despair when we have a whole ranching industry that is literally dying, Western ranching culture, and we can't get this simple, simple point over to people.
That's because systems are not adaptable, but plans are. Is that basically what you're saying?
No, it's not adaptable. Planning is a four-letter, it's not a four-letter word. It's not an event. It's a process. I always say planning is a 24-letter word. Plan, monitor, control, replan. It's 24 letters. It's one process. And a big part of the holistic plan raising process is the control. So if anything isn't working, you control immediately. And I would just be repeating myself. When 2,000 range scientists and others cannot even make it theoretically fail, damn it, we need to be doing it.
What are some common mistakes that you see grazers making as they are trying to implement plans and monitor and replan?
I only see one. They drop the planning.
They make their plan and they don't follow through with it? Or how does that?
They just drop the planning process. I use that in the textbook. We ran two advanced projects in Zimbabwe years ago, before I even went public. A big ranching company, the biggest ranching company at one time in the world, wanted my advice. They had 60,000 cows on over a million acre ranch. And I said, look, everybody in the world says I'm wrong. I do not want you to take my advice and run into trouble or anything like that. So they said, what do you propose? I said, give me the worst land you've got. Let me show you how the process works. And if you are happy, we then proceed. They chose the worst land they had, 4,000 acres, where I offered a £5 note if somebody could even find one grass plant. Okay? And on that, we trebled the stocking rate immediately in the first year, produced solid grassland, no range management, none of the stuff, just the holistic plan grazing process. That went for 8 years, just got better and better and better. Then I had to go into exile because our situation was worsening, and it was 4 years till I could get back. Now, both advanced projects and over 100 ranches that I'd been working with on 5 countries in Africa, all of which had been going extremely well, every single one of them had dropped the planning and was deteriorating. The advanced project, the one in the dry area, had destocked completely. And when I went over it with them and said, okay, you guys, what happened? They said, drought. And I said, BS. Droughts don't overgraze plants. Every single plant on this land is overgrazed. Droughts don't do that. So I said, what happened when I left? And they were honest. They said, we breathed a sigh of relief. You're gone. You were no longer nagging us, supervising, making us plan. And they said, they dropped the planning. And they just did what they'd always done. It was so simple. It was a flat piece of land. They had 30 paddocks, and they just kept moving the cattle every one or two days, adjusting, watching the grass, watching the cattle. Well, it collapsed completely. They had dropped the planning process. And the planning process has an aid memoir that you follow, and I follow that aid. I developed it. I've been doing it for 50 years. I still don't do it without the aid. I just follow the aid memoir, and one step builds on another, and comes out with the best possible plan at any point in time on that ranch, no matter how complicated, no matter how bad the drought, anything else. It always produces the best possible plan at that point in time from the rancher's mind.
So what is the goal of the planning process? What are you trying to do in the end with the planning process?
Just get people to succeed in using livestock to bring about the life they want. Almost everybody's wanting more profitability, more stability, a better life. Now, if you're living in seasonal rainfall environments of the world, all the grazing systems, all the rotational grazing, everything else is causing desertification, as you're seeing over most of the United States, all right, and globally. Now, that's not what people want, all right? So to correct that, no technology in the world can ever do it. Fire can't do it. Those are the only two tools humans have other than resting the land or conservation. And so of the three tools we have, technology, fire, or resting or conservation, two of them cause desertification, and the third, technology, cannot correct it. So any rancher in America, if they want highly productive land, stable land, combating climate change, saving the Western launching culture, it's very simple. They just need more cattle, holistic land grazing, and it will do it. And that's what most people would like to do. So when you say, what's the aim? It's just to help people succeed.
What does that success look like? I mean, on the land, what does the land look like when we have succeeded, or when we are succeeding, I should say?
Well, I would use the example of Dibungombe, the ranch that I donated in Africa, and I live on it still. And I'm watching that. Now, we've had 12 bad years, 12 years below average or just on average. That, in anybody's language, would be a terrible situation. We cannot keep pace with the production of the land. It is just mind-boggling how productive that land is becoming. It doesn't matter how dry the year is. It's just improving, improving, improving. That's what the end result should be for everybody. And there's nothing I'm doing there with the staff and the people there that is at all difficult. It's all explained in the book. It's all been taught, etc. We're just doing it with herding. We don't use any fencing. People there have done it far from perfectly. They've made many mistakes. It doesn't matter. It's very forgiving if you just get the planning process going.
We are looking at a movement within agriculture today of people being concerned with regenerating the land, thanks in large part to your work. Where do you see the regenerative agriculture movement today?
Well, it's moving nicely, as you say. A lot of people are talking about it, etc. Now, there's a very real danger that it'll become another greenwash, another cliche, like organic, sustainable, you name it. They all do, and exploited by people. So I recently put out a blog explaining what regenerative agriculture is. And it's not any specific practice. And I credit Robert Rodale with it. He was the first man to come up with the term regenerative agriculture that would regenerate communities, economies, towns, etc., through the farming. So I put out a blog on that recently, and people can look at it on my Facebook site. And essentially what I said was regenerative agriculture will be agriculture that is dealing with the cause of global desertification and climate change. So it'll be addressing that cause, and in doing so, it will be addressing the complexity, social, environmental, economic, etc., of fisheries, forestry, crop production, everything, because agriculture is the production of food and fiber from the world's land and water. It's not cropping, it's not livestock, it's fisheries, forestry, wildlife, it's all agriculture, right? So it'll be agriculture that's addressing the cause of climate change, and the best practices will be floating to the top. So some of the practices will come from mainstream disruptive agriculture, some will come from permaculture, some will come from biodynamic agriculture, some will come from traditional people. But the moment you are managing holistically, the correct processes or practices rise to the top without any conflict. Whereas if you and I got into discussing practices, I can guarantee you argument. Because as soon as we put forward any practice, silviculture, whatever it is, practice of the livestock, whatever, somebody else puts another practice forward. And so we argue and bicker and continue with slow incremental change. Slow incremental change isn't going to help humans now. We need to be uniting, collaborating, and not in conflict. Now, nearly all of this conflict that we get into between different practices, etc., is nobody is to blame for it. It is brought about by the very thing that is causing climate change. So if you wonder what is causing climate change, if you look at society and all our institutions, they have total certainty. Climate change is being caused by livestock, emitting methane, etc., etc., coal and oil. Now, right up to Nobel laureates, they're certain about that. Well, as I said in the TED talk, once we were equally certain that the world was flat. We were wrong then and we're wrong again. Livestock, coal and oil are resources. Just use common sense. No resource can cause a problem. It is how you manage the resources that causes the problem. So it is how we manage livestock with rotational and other grazing systems that cause desertification in the seasonal rainfall environments of the world. They don't cause it in the humid east and west coast of America, Europe, etc. They just cause biodiversity loss there, right? It is management that calls coal and oil fossil fuels and burns them rapidly. So it is management with 100% certainty, and I don't believe any scientist can argue this, that is the cause of climate change and of agriculture being the most extractive, destructive industry ever in history. Agriculture today is more destructive than coal, oil, or any other extractive industry. That's what has to stop with regenerative agriculture.
Is agriculture the most destructive industry because of the destruction of grasslands how does that look in your mind?
Oh no, it's destructive because of the destruction of biodiversity in the oceans. We're killing the oceans, we're killing the ocean, the continental shelves with silt getting onto them. Agriculture is producing 20 times as much dead eroding soil as we need. Food today, that's mostly from the croplands because they ignored and didn't know most of the other land was desertifying. Agriculture is leading to the burning of billions of hectares of grasslands every year, contributing enormously. So it's throughout. It's in the fisheries, the forestry, the croplands. We've never had an industry as extractive and destructive as agriculture is today. Now, again, Clay, let's use common sense. You can talk to even an illiterate person or semi-educated person, and they know that all of agriculture should be based on the biological sciences. That is common sense. Now, because of our institutions, universities, corporations, governments, etc., and they never behave like a human does, they assume a life of their own, and you get institutional stupidity, as I call it. Agriculture today is fundamentally based on chemistry and marketing of technology. That is just stupid self-destruction. And that's only going to stop by ordinary people like you and I talking about it, you and I doing interviews like this, getting the knowledge out to the public, social networking, because only when the public opinion shifts do our institutions stop being stupid.
when the market demands new practices, and is that what you're saying? When the market demands new practices?
No, public opinion shifts. If you look at what you and I are talking about today, it's counterintuitive, right? It's paradigm shifting. Now, there's no case I can find in the history of the world where any human organization has ever accepted counterintuitive new scientific insights ahead of public opinion changing. Our institutions ridicule and oppose new scientific insights until public opinion shifts. That's why, although the first organizations to have supported, to should have supported my work, were cattlemen's organizations and environmental, not a single cattlemen's organization has supported my work to this day. Thousands of ranchers have, but not their organizations. Their organizations still mock, ridicule, hold it at arm's length, because not enough ranching opinion has changed yet.
So that leads to a question. How far has regenerative agriculture come in the 50 years or so that it has been progressing? How far has it come in your mind?
It's hardly moved at all. At least now it's on the radar. When Bob Brodale was talking about this with me 30-odd years ago, and we were talking about how we might do it, etc., it was just a handful of people talking about it. Everybody was talking about permaculture or biodynamic agriculture, organic or sustainable agriculture. Now, all of these other agricultures that are wonderful and will be part of the solutions in the end, do remember that everything in the past was organic or sustainable, as we call it today. We hadn't had coal and oil. Everything was grass-fed. And that organic, sustainable agriculture destroyed more civilizations than armies have done. So that's not what we want. But within that are some wonderful practices that will float to the top. That, I promise you, as soon as people manage holistically. So that managing holistically, that process just helps you find which practices from any source are socially, environmentally, economically right for you today. Now, and they may not be right for you 10 years from now as the scene changes.
Can you talk about how previous versions of agriculture, even far back into history, caused the downfall of civilizations? What were you referring to there?
I'm referring to exactly the same thing as today. All the management throughout history has been reductionist. So when we say that, well, I say management is what is causing the problem, what we didn't know and only discovered in 1984 is that all management by humans, and the only things we manage are organizations or nature, from families to governments and nature. Everything else, if you think about it, is something we make. And what we make is wonderfully successful because it's never complex. Even space exploration vehicles do not involve complexity. Now, everything we manage is complex. And it is our inability to do that that caused past civilizations to fail. Now we do know how to do it, and we'll get better and better at it once we get more people doing it. Rebecca Costa wrote an excellent book, The Watchman's Rattle, and she reasoned out that the early civilizations didn't just fail because of their agriculture. They failed, she said, because their societies could not address the complexity of rising population and deteriorating environment. So they turned away from science, their sources of knowledge, to sacrifice, to religion and sacrifice, and they shelved the problems for future generations. Well, they failed. That's almost exactly what we're doing globally today. People are turning more and more to religions, etc. Many people are turning away from science in America, and they're shelving these problems for future generations, and they will fail. That's why it's terribly important that this youth movement today, with Greta Thunberg in at the UN recently, with the American youth where they're saying we don't even want to go to school if need be, We want a future. They are right. Now, they will produce nothing but conflict and confusion unless we get new knowledge to them. They won't do any better than adults did. Because at the end of the day, you have to be able to manage complexity. And that is what holistic management is enabling us to do, and now we should build on it and develop it as fast as we can. Just like once the Wright brothers showed us how to fly, within 70 years we were on the moon. Now that we know how to manage holistically, manage complexity, the human spirit should be able to fly. We can't get there at the moment, mostly because of academic egos and resistance from institutions.
If this podcast is adding value to your ranch business, I would just ask you to stick around. At the end, I've got a way that you can help the show out, and I promise you, you listening to me explain how you can help the show will take longer than the actual task of helping the show. So please stick around after this interview for an explanation of that. Thank you.
So a lot of this is coming down to an issue of managing the social tensions, which holistic management does address. How should we approach the external social pressures that are coming to ranching? How should we tackle those relationships?
Well, those are part of the same thing. You see, all of the policies are reductionist, etc. If I was could wave a magic wand, and I was a leader, say, of a cattleman's organization, a ranching cattleman's organization of America, what I would do is stand up and publicly say, yes, we acknowledge the land is deteriorating. Stop denying it. And just say, we acknowledge it. We're terribly worried about it, but we notice that national parks are deteriorating even worse. We notice that land managed by environmental organizations is deteriorating even worse. I showed some of it in the TED Talk. National parks that are worse than anything in Africa. We've got them in New Mexico. Okay. And say, look, we should all be worried about this. And then let's get together and start discussing it and doing something. Instead of which, they spend years fighting the environmental organizations, and both sides are wrong. Both sides are using the same reductionist management that leads to conflict.
So on the environmental side, the reductionist management is to cut fossil fuels, but not give attention to proper grazing and management of animal resources. Is that how you see it?
Well, let's just look at a person who's done wonderfully well, Al Gore. He's really represented the environmental side. He's got a Nobel Prize for it. He's done wonderfully well. And he recently gave a second TED Talk with great enthusiasm and excitement. But so I'm not detracting from that at all, but just think about it a little deeply. What was he talking about and so excited about? He was excited about the rapid rate at which people are beginning to make electricity from sun and wind. Once more, we're making something, we're not dealing with complexity. So even that person who's doing wonderfully well, amazingly well, never spoke a word about the cause of climate change or global desertification. And so it is with all the environmental organizations. I mean, some of the worst loss of biodiversity, habitat destruction in Africa is around our property in national parks. And we cannot even get environmental organizations to look at it, take it seriously. When I gave a talk in Godalming, in England, at the headquarters of the World Wildlife Fund, which I was invited to do by a friend of mine who'd been at university with me, who was working in World Wildlife Fund. I went to the headquarters, met them, great people, wonderful people, doing a great job. And then I went to the room where I had the projector and everything to give my talk, and they boycotted it, even though I traveled all the way to London to give the talk in their own headquarters. That was 35 years ago. And they're still like that, still just boycotting. They should be the people most concerned about biodiversity loss in national parks. Now, nobody's to blame for that. If you look at the tools, we're a tool-using animal. You cannot even drink water without using technology unless you go to the nearest river now and drink with your hands and mouth. We cannot do anything without technology. No money can do anything. No creativity can do anything. No labor can do anything until you pick up a tool. Now, the tools that environmentalists have and all scientists have are not thousands as they believe. They're technology. Nearly every tool comes under the heading of technology. From our first sticks and stones, okay, that was our earliest technology, like any tool using animal, and we could not affect our environment. Then, way back, about 1 million years ago, we got our second tool, which was fire. First we used to use fire, we learnt, and then we learnt to make fire. Then we could melt the stones, go into the bronze, the copper age, the iron age, and develop the technology you and I are using today. Not a single thing in that room behind you that I'm looking at, or on your body, not a single thing there could be made without fire.
Right.
Okay, so you had two tools. Now, the only other tool we ever developed was the idea of conservation or resting the environment to let it recover. So now you've got three tools. Now, if you are an environmental organization and you're trying to save biodiversity, it's wonderful in one-third of the world or in the oceans and lakes. We're resting the environment, it recovers. No matter how badly damaged, it recovers even in changed form. So when we look at civilizations that failed in Yucatan or anywhere that it's humid, tropical jungles, etc., we find the forest fully recovered, we find the jungle over the ruins. Now, if you look at most of the world, most of the United States, where rainfall is seasonal, where you get months of dryness and then rain, and it can be high rainfall or it can be low, it doesn't matter, it's seasonal, then resting the environment or conservation is the most destructive tool we have. That's why national parks in those environments are deteriorating. Now, what are we going to do about it? That I covered in the TED Talk. No technology in the world can correct that. Fire can't, and resting land or conservation can't. And the only other idea humans have come up with, and there's been a Nobel Prize was given for it, is to plant trees. Now, that can't do anything to solve the problem of desertification because it's not addressing the cause of desertification. So the United Arab Emirates, where I've been looking at it, they spent over $30 billion desalinating, planting trees, and the desert sands just marching through it. The Chinese are planting millions of trees, and the desert sands are blowing into Beijing now. So what else are you going to do? So at the end of it all, you've got no option, literally no option but to use livestock. And that, as you know, the public vilifies, and celebrities now vilify. I wish some scientists somewhere in the world would show where I'm wrong.
That should be good news that we as ranchers are managing the tool that is the only hope, as I've heard you say.
If ranchers would do it.
Is that the barrier, doing it? Or is there a falling down in communication? Or is it mostly the planning, as you said, and the actual doing it? Or is there something we can do differently to communicate?
I don't know the answer to that. I wish I did. Why it is that we know with pretty good certainty that if you want to live longer and healthier, all you've got to do is eat less and exercise more. Thousands, millions of people make New Year's resolutions. There's a multi-billion dollar industry in running shoes and exercise machines. How many people do it? In the United States, I believe I'm correct, something like 300,000 people die a year with obesity-related diseases. Isn't that more deaths than we had in two world wars? Can you explain that to me?
No.
I can't explain to you how simple it is to get any rancher and make them more successful, but they don't do it. Now, Deb Steiner and some co-workers did a paper where they studied early adopters, people who came to me when I first came to the United States. Those people, almost majority of them, came to me because they were broke. Now, when Deb Steiner and her research co-workers did that study that's cited in my book, right? They found studying early adopters of holistic management across the United States, they averaged 300% more profit. Now, those farmers were operating in the same markets and everything at over about that same time period. Over 600,000 American farm families went broke, and suicide was the leading cause of death. Now, here were these people practicing something new they'd learned. They'd come to learn it because they were going broke. They were frank about that, and they were averaging 300% more profit. You'd think that paper would be cited and cited and cited. No academics ever refer to it.
We are, it seems, a self-sabotaging creature in some regard.
We are.
What is your perspective on the Green New Deal? Have you been paying attention to that, and what can we do?
Yeah, I've been paying attention to it. The motive is right. It's excellent. The idea is right. But you and I can work this out ourselves now. What management and policies will they do it? How will they develop their policies in the new Green Deal? I can guarantee you it, because all humans do the same. All right? They will put together sophisticated teams of scientists, interdisciplinary scientists, who are all aware that their policies may have economic and social and environmental consequences, and they'll come up with their policies. Now, when they come up with those policies, because every policy, this is the way it's done, all right, they will reduce that complexity to the problem, be it immigration or land degradation or invasive plants or drug use or whatever it is, they'll reduce it to the problem as the context or reason for the policy. And that is why I can guarantee you their failure now. That is reductionist. And if you read my textbook, I say to many people, the sentence in it that is the most telling has never been challenged since the first edition. And it's never, ever referred to. People just ignore it. And that sentence came from about 30 scientists and others training with me when I was training 2,000 people at the request of USDA. And they made a statement after discussing. And we wrote it down, and I quoted it in the book. And that statement was, we now recognize that unsound resource management is universal in the United States. Now, when professional people can look at their own policies with a week of training and determine that, to me, we should have got moving. We didn't. What happened was that all future training of government people was banned.
What are some other challenges that you see the regenerative agriculture movement facing?
I don't see any other challenge. They've got to overcome this one, or it will not be regenerative. If they do not address the cause of agriculture being so destructive, no amount of practices will be regenerative. They'll be no more successful than anybody has been in agriculture over the last 15,000 years.
If you could ask people listening to do one thing, and my audience is ranchers mostly, what would you challenge them to do? What would you ask them to do?
Get involved and start learning. Just go direct to the source. There's so many people mimicking now. There's so many grazing gurus and grass whisperers living. Everything comes from either Wozan or myself. Go to the original. That is why my wife and I got Wozan's book republished in the United States, because nobody was referring to him and people were distorting his work. They can get our textbook. They can go to Savory Institute. There's self-help training material. Hubs are developing all over. We have the first university-led hub in Michigan now. We've got something like 40 hubs on 6 continents where farmers, ranchers, pastoralists, academics, government agency people are just getting together and starting to manage holistically. So there's absolutely nothing stopping any rancher in the United States from saving his family, saving his ranch. The only thing standing in his way or her way is themselves.
Yeah. I think I heard Charles Massey say the square foot of real estate between their ears is the thing that's keeping them from from going forward?
You know, let me tell you a story, because it's so typical, and I don't have answers to that, but there was a fellow I helped years ago, and we got his ranch going. It was very successful. He knew how to do the planned grazing. It's about an hour and a half's work twice a year. It's not a lot of work. That's all it is, literally. And I suggested he go on his own. I said, keep going on your own now. Just call me if you have trouble, because I need to help other people. Because I was so swamped. I was helping people in five countries. I'd had to buy a plane to fly around to get to them all. And so he went on his own. And about 2 years later, I got a panic phone call from him one night. Would I come and see him? He had had a fire sweep through half the ranch. He had water where there was no grass, grass where there was no water. He was in a panic. He had to destock, and he wanted me to come out and help him decide how much to destock by. So I said, all right, meet me at the airfield, which he did the next morning. And when we met, he wanted to go and look at the cattle, look at the burnt land. I said, no, I don't want to look at that. I want to look at your plan. I want to see your planning. He said, well, Alan, I haven't planned. There's no point, because I don't know how many cattle I'm going to have. I said, no, that's the whole point of planning. He said, you've got a plan. So we argued, and he wanted to go and look at the cattle and the grass, and I didn't want to look. I said, look, I'll learn nothing if I look at another million acres of burnt ground. I'll learn nothing if I look at another million cattle. All I can learn is from your planning. So we go and plan, or we don't. And he said, no, he wanted to go and look at the ranch. And I said, fine, stop wasting your money and my time. And I walked towards the plane. So he backed down at that point and agreed to go to the house and look at the planning. So we got out the plan. He hadn't planned since I'd left him for 2 years. He'd just been rotating the cattle, doing what he thought he'd always done, watching the cattle in the grass, being adaptive and so on. And so we got the chart out, and he protested every step. I said, just follow the aid. And to cut a long story short, I never gave him any advice. I just stood over him and made him do the planning. And every bit of knowledge was in his head. It came out onto the paper, onto the plan. He began to relax more and more. At the end of it, I said, now, looking at that plan, is there anywhere that's worrying you? And we made allowance for the water drying up earlier. We made allowance for the grass not growing for another 2 months beyond when it normally would. Everything was very conservatively planned. And he said, there's a couple of areas that we might worry about. I said, let's go and check those in the field. We did, and he didn't have to destock at all. That fellow saved $50,000 to $100,000 in under 2 hours. And every bit of knowledge was in his head. And that is almost every rancher in the world I'm talking about. They just don't do it. As I sort of jokingly say, because I know, because I'm like that myself, we males, it's mostly males, have got a disease. We don't know if it's sexually transmitted, but when our hand touches paper, we come out in a cold sweat. If we pick up a pencil, it really sweats, and we run to the coffee shop for therapeutic treatment, to talk to our mates and complain about the government and the weather and the price of cattle. We are the problem. And that's why women make much better managers of ranches than men.
Absolutely.
They tend to do the planning, which the men won't do.
In your mind, how will agriculture be different 30 years from now if regenerative agriculture takes hold and people catch the vision?
If regenerative agriculture, if you go to that blog of mine explaining it, and I can send you the information on that, if regenerative agriculture becomes what it should be, in other words, agriculture that's managed holistically, policy at government level, etc., and on the farms and ranches, all right, incorporating the best of all current forms of agriculture in holistic management so that we deal with the cause of the problem, then in 30 years' time, it'll be incredible. Just like we put a man on the moon within 70 years, because most people are good, most people are doing their best. Our institutions do not behave like a human. They're part of the problem, as I've explained many times. All right? So the moment we begin to address the cause, I have tremendous faith that we will see unbelievable progress and change. Now, if the cause isn't addressed, 30 years from now, you'll be having the same discussion like this.
Is the regenerative agriculture, when it comes to cropland, is that simply following the soil health principles and incorporating livestock and maintaining cover on the land and some of those things? Or how does that row crop agriculture become regenerative in the way that it's managed?
Okay, when people manage holistically, what they have to do, all right, when somebody makes a suggestion, any suggestion like you do, you say, well, I want to do row crops or I want to involve livestock winning, the automatic reaction I have if I'm working with them is to say, good idea. Right? It's like if you say to me, or if I say to you, Clay, I'm going to light a match, I'm going to light a fire, and I start reaching for my matches. Do you know if it's a good idea or not?
No.
You don't know until you know the context. All right? So when you say to me, I'm going to be in regenerative agriculture, that's not a context. I'm going to be plant, that's not a context. I need to know the context. The reason why you're doing, bringing livestock on or doing any cropping practice. All right. Now, always today with permaculture, with biodynamic, with any agriculture, you're the best of them. All right. If you look at the reason for the farmer's action, it is always to meet a need, a desire, or to solve a problem. That I can guarantee. To meet a need, more profit, more income, more production, whatever. To meet a desire, I want to run chickens, I want to run pigs, and it'll meet my need or desire for more profit. Do you see what I'm getting at? That is reductionist management. That is what is causing climate change. That is what has got to change. So if you were sitting with me and you were a farmer, I'd be saying, Clay, who's managing your farm? Is it you, your spouse? What about your children? What about the people who work on the farm, the humans who make decisions on that farm? Let's get together, because at the end of the day in management, you're trying to improve your life. That's what management's about. So let's define and determine what sort of life do you want to lead? What do you want your life to be based on your culture, your spiritual values and everything? And you spell that out with your family, your people working on that farm. All right. And then we would say, and now you've got a market you've got to deal with. You've got government agencies you've got to deal with and all these things. How are you going to have them be totally loyal to you and support you? You can't do anything about them. You can only look at your own behavior. So how are you going to be? Because at the end of the day, you're judged by your behavior, not your words, not your slogans, not your logo. So how is your behavior going to have to be? Honest, open-minded, integrity, whatever. Not a little bit. You can't be a little bit pregnant. Okay? And then we would say, now, this farm of yours, at the moment, it's in a terrible state. Ignore that. What will this farm of yours have to be like 500 years from now for your descendants to be living like that? Get you beyond species, not arguing about species, describing water effectiveness of rainfall, biological community and complexity, solar energy flow through that to money and life. Now we have a context. Now we have a reason for actions. Now let's look at your idea of row cropping or whatever, and we'd see if it's in that context. We'd see if it gets beyond the problems, etc. And we have seven little checks that we train people to do, because very quickly you begin to intuitively make better decisions and better practices start to come forward. And if there's any argument or doubt, we have seven little questions that you can be trained in a day to use to just check that your action is in that context and not just dealing with a problem or just meeting your desire. That's it. And that is so simple that I've literally, just illiterate people learn it quickly. The only two things that I've found ever block learning are not ignorance or anything like that. The only two things block learning are our egos and what we already know for certain. But if we can set those aside for a moment, anybody can learn this quickly.
So what's next for the Savory Institute for Holistic Management? What's next? What's the future? You've talked about learning hubs and some of those things. What are you guys working on? What's coming down the pike from you guys?
Well, I'm getting old now. I'm in the departure lounge. So younger people, much more capable than me, are taking over. Daniela Howell is the CEO, and she's got a wonderful staff under her. I'm really impressed with what they're doing. And they're pursuing the strategy of looking at the world's grasslands first, because that's where we can make the most change, most rapidly for pastures and ranches. So they're looking at that first, and doing it through this hub strategy, which I think is brilliant. We've tried many things that just don't work well. This seems to be working, where ordinary people are just getting together and learning. So we're focusing in each country, each state, whatever, on trying to get people to help themselves work in their own communities, their own language, their own culture, locally led, locally managed. That seems to be going very well indeed, and so we'll just keep pushing that. And then I sort of float around a little bit like a loose cannon on the deck, and I'm trying wherever I can to get people somewhere to focus on policy, because policies are unsound everywhere. America hasn't got a monopoly on unsound policy. Universal, when I worked with foresters in India, in just 1 week, they looked at 12 forestry policies in India, and they determined that all 12 policies would damage their communities, damage their economy, damage their policies. But again, nothing changed because they're institutions. When I did the same in Lesotho with soil erosion, we did forest policy and soil conservation policy with their officials. They determined both would get worse because of the policies, but nothing changed. So I've got to get a policy changing somewhere, and if it's going to happen, I think it'll be in a small country with authoritarian government or deeply in trouble, like my own, Zimbabwe. That's why I concentrate there a lot. So that's what I'm trying to do, is to see if we can get a policy changed somewhere.
Well, Alan, I really appreciate your time today. This will be episode 75 of the Working Cows podcast, so the show notes page will be at workingcows.net/75. You mentioned Andre Voisin's book that you got republished. What was the name of that book? I know a few.
I think that's
Grass Productivity. Okay.
And I got a lovely letter from his wife thanking us. I never met him, unfortunately.
Right.
Brilliant.
I'll make sure that's in the show notes page at workingcows.net/75. Any other links, savory.global, anything else?
No, just if people can get information there. That's the most up-to-date, constantly information, best materials. It's just straight from there.
Let me say this. Thank you for your work. Thank you for your passion and for continuing to hold the line on what it's going to take for ranchers to improve their life, as you said at the beginning of this episode.
Well, thank you, Clay, for helping get the word out. They're wonderful people, and we've got to save this Western ranching culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your time today. If you're new to the show, we are engaged in a competition right now here at the Working Cows Podcast. If you want to vote for the Working Cows Podcast, you can do so at workingcows.net/vote. Well, what a privilege it was to sit down with Alan and to have an opportunity just to ask him about his thoughts on the industry as a whole, and I really count it as a privilege. I'm looking forward to continuing on in this march towards the 100, but what a milestone to sit down here with Alan Savory and talk to him about the industry as a whole. There have been a few episodes where the paradigm challenge has been strong with this one, and next week's episode is one of those episodes in particular. I'm really looking forward to talking to Charlie Arnott on the subject of biodynamics. So tune in next week for episode 76 of the Working Cows Podcast with Charlie Arnott on biodynamics.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.